all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon, America. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I am your host today on Veterans Radio, and it is our privilege to be in your living room, or at least in your ears, wherever they may be, to talk about veterans and veterans stories and veterans affairs and veterans issues that are going on around the world. And we want you to be participate in the conversation today, so feel free to give us a call here at WAAM at 734-822-1600. We're going to be talking about the Veterans History Project, and many of you are familiar with that, and I'm very excited to talk to our guest with that, Ed Runkle, in just a moment, and to let you know how you can go about recording your veteran stories or your relatives' veteran stories and store them in the Library of Congress, which is really kind of cool when you think about it. I did this a number of years ago, and I can just go into the Library of Congress, or my grandson did this, typed in grandpa's name, and came up an interview and talked all about what I was doing when I was in the service. So this is a great opportunity for many of you out there. We're going to be talking about how you can record stories of your relatives and can upload them to the Library of Congress. And I think it's a pretty neat experiment program that they have out there. The second half of the program, we're going to be talking about the last days in Vietnam. There's a documentary that is going to be shown on PBS this coming Tuesday evening. Check your local PBS station for the time. Exactly. It's 9 o'clock Eastern. And it's a documentary about when they had to evacuate Vietnam. And I'm really excited to talk to our guest, Colonel Stuart Harrington, who was there at the time and is an active participant in the documentary, which, by the way, was directed and produced by Rory Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy's daughter. And it's a very powerful documentary. I had the privilege of watching it the other night. You can download it onto your computer, and we'll talk more about different ways that you can get a hold of it. But for those of you that were in Vietnam, I think it's really important that you hear this story. It's a story of honor. It's a story of gumption. There are heroics going on there. There are promises kept, some promises not kept. It's an emotional roller coaster, and I'm anxious to talk to Colonel Harrington when we get to that at the bottom of the hour. But right now, joining us on Veterans Radio is Ed Runkle. And Ed, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you very much, Dale, and a pleasure to be with you today. I've been looking forward to the conversation.
I know you have. Am I mispronouncing your name? I wanted to make sure I had it right. It's Runkle, right?
No, Ed Ruckle's just fine.
Okay, Ed Runkle is an Air Force veteran. Were you career Air Force?
Absolutely. Actually, I'm a Canadian boy that served with the United States Air Force for over 20, from 61 through 81. And then returned back to Canada here in Windsor in 1988.
So I went through flight school with a number of guys from Canada, and I thought that was always a fascinating story. It's like, you know, what are you coming over here for? You could avoid this whole thing and just kind of stay home, considering that there were people from our country that were going there to get away from this whole war thing. So did you ever end up serving overseas?
Actually, I went all over the world, but I never went to Vietnam. And part of that was because I was Canadian and didn't get the various clearances, apparently, whatever. They sent me to Osan, Korea in 1970, so I lucked out. I didn't have to go to Vietnam.
Yes.
But many Canadians did. So
They did. Sometimes I wonder if it's lucking out or not. But it was an experience, let's put it that way. Actually, one that I don't think I would want... I wouldn't want to repeat it, but I'm grateful that I went through it.
Well, I think about 33,000, if my numbers serve me correctly, did serve from Canada and the other nations, Australia, et cetera, in the early days of NAM. And then, of course, they pulled back and the Americans took it over, and whatever happened there, it just happened. But
well, that's true.
I was lucky. I didn't have to go.
No, yeah. Well, we worked with the... We worked with the Australians quite a bit in the area of operation that I was in, and that was quite the adventure for me, meeting up with some Australians. They do some serious beer drinking. I guess I couldn't even clean that up. I couldn't clean that up anyway.
And they
would challenge us to participate with them, and it was not a contest at all. But anyway. All right, Ed, I'm really excited to talk to you today about this Veterans History Project. And I was reading something off of the other website that you gave me that's on the flyer and up on our website. It's about the veterans tributes, and these numbers are fascinating to me. And I think that this is going to be imperative and kind of accelerate the need to record these stories. Is that your mission?
Oh, I agree. Yes.
Mission statement for the Veterans Tribute says, according to a 2013 census, there are approximately 19.6 million military veterans in the United States. When we started this program in 2003, there were almost 25 million.
Yeah, that's dwindling.
That's 6 million veterans who have passed away in the last 10 years. So we got a little urgency here with our story then. So tell me all about this Veterans History Project.
Well, the Veterans History, it's kind of ironic because here about a year and a half ago, I went over to the VA just to get a VA card. I didn't plan on doing Veterans History. I really didn't know much about it at all, and that was a year and a half ago. Went over, got my VA card, and before I knew it, I was a volunteer, and I was asked to capture veteran stories and send them off to the Library of Congress, the Veterans History Project there. And I thought, well, that seems like a kind of a cool idea. I was looking for something to do, eh? So I started it and got it going. And this was at the John Dingell VA Center down on John R. in Detroit. And that's only about 15 minutes for me once I crossed the border, right? And then it went over there and started to work with it. And I was actually started with the veterans on the sixth floor of the John Dingell VA. And that's the long-term World War II guys.
Oh, okay.
And I had the opportunity to meet many of them. And one in particular was Lewis Calvin Huff. Buck was his name. He was 96 years old and actually walked with George Patton back in the 30s. And was also one of the G1 staff to the 92nd Infantry, the Black Buffalo Soldiers. So he had a tremendous amount of history. And he was my first story to capture and send off to the Library of Congress. And it just went on from there. And then I realized that I was missing about 96% of my veterans because I was up on the third floor trying to capture them at the VA Medical Center there in their media room.
Mm-hmm.
And that took me off of the floor, and I was missing just a wealth of history that was walking past me down on the main floor of the VA. About 600 veterans a day go through that VA. And in one shape, form, or another, and that covers all branches of the service, and I've just met a tremendous amount of veterans lately, and that's where the Veterans Tributes came in. I thought I could catch short stories from them on the fly, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's basically what began, and it took off, and today I have about 91 veterans who have signed up to tell either a long or an extended story. And extended stories are stories that actually meet the 30-minute rule set by the Library of Congress. If it's less than 30, they usually don't take it, okay?
Oh, okay.
And a lot of veterans don't believe they can tell a story and go that long, but they can. And I didn't look at the criteria. Veterans were going to be, had to be in a war or a combat zone. Because many of us, I didn't serve in a combat zone, was in over 20 years and didn't serve in a combat zone.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean that we, weren't going to go into a combat zone.
Right.
I think that's the risk, and people have to understand. So anyway, I started to collect stories from any veteran that had a pulse in 98.6. And it started to work pretty good. And today we've got close to almost 100. And I think 21 have been sent off to the Library of Congress, and another 7 or 8 in the next week or two that's going to be going.
We're going to take a quick little break here, Ed. And when we come back, I want to kind of go through a pretend interview.
All right.
And just to let our audience know that what the questions are that you ask and all the other people that ask that are participating in the Veterans History Project as the recorders. So we'll be right back with Ed. Runkle here on Veterans Radio. We'll be talking about the Veterans History Project. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
He's 5 foot 2 and he's 6 feet 4. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. Been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the red, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Lobau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there, and you and me, and brothers.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and that's the Universal Soldier. And the reason that I picked that particular tune as for a bump music today is because we are talking about the Veterans History Project with Ed Runkle, who is a United States Air Force, retired after 20 years. And just before we took the break, Ed mentioned something, you know, that he was in the service for 20 years, but he didn't get into combat. And that doesn't matter to me. It never matters to us here on Veterans Radio, because all of us signed up, some voluntarily, some not necessarily quite so voluntarily, but we signed up to do our duty and we did it. Wherever we were assigned, that's where we went. And we were always on edge that we might be sent somewhere else. And so you just never know. And even though you may not have been in combat, there are so many great stories out there, Ed, from people that I have met doing this program for the last 11 years that are just as powerful as any story that I've heard from somebody who's been, you know, been getting shot at.
Correct. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And many veterans actually don't think they have a story to tell because they haven't been in combat. But as you said so well there, is when you work, the thing that makes the military so special is that when you go to work in the morning as a soldier, as an airman or whatever, you don't know if you're coming back home.
That's very
You could
true.
Very well be deployed, and I was in SAC for 3 years, and you could very well not get home for months. So those are the prices that are paid, and those are the stories we try to capture. Every vet has a story, and once they get them talking, there's something else.
That is true. And I think that, you know, probably all of us have stories of, you know, even if just basic training stories. I mean, it's such a culture shock for probably, you know, 95% of the men and especially the women who go through basic training that there has to be a story there, because you are meeting people that you would never meet in your everyday life.
You know, correct.
Think about, you know, just think about, you know, where these men and women were from. And in my experience, I'm from New Jersey originally, and I ended up going to basic training in Fort Polk, Louisiana. I had never been to Louisiana, and no offense to anybody who's listening from Louisiana, but you guys talk funny. And I couldn't understand anything that anybody was saying. And the drill sergeant, he had something against my family. I'm not sure where they, you know, the things that he would say to us on a regular basis. But some of those men that I met there turned out to be lifelong friends.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Currently, and you make a good point there. And I'm currently working with the Mumford Point Marines. And they go back into World War II, and I'm currently gathering a story in the cloud-based application that I have, and I'm talking with a 93-year-old Mumford Point Marine, African-American gentleman, who is the oldest living Mumford Point Marine, period.
What is a Mumford Point Marine?
Mumford Point Marines, in 1942, you know, World War II, Roosevelt mandated that all the military would integrate African-Americans into the Corps and the other branch services as well. The Corps didn't want them. So when they went to Camp Lejeune to get their basic training, they didn't train with the white soldiers at Camp Lejeune. They stuck them out at Mumford Point, out near the swamplands, and that's where they trained them as a separate, totally separate unit. They were still Marines, but they weren't integrated as such. And that's the Mumford Point Marines.
Well, I know there are...
A story in itself.
Oh, absolutely. I know there are great stories because we had done some stories with the Tuskegee Airmen.
These were the other buddies, yep.
Right, and there are so many Tuskegee Airmen that live in the Detroit area that none of us were really aware of it until we came across, Colonel Armstrong, I think his name is. And he was the one that we've had on the program a couple of times, and just fascinating stories. And so let me get into this little interview process. So let's suppose that my Uncle Joe was in Korea, and I want to interview him. I've heard about the Veterans History Project. How do I go about doing this?
Well, the first thing you got to do, and this is how I do it now, and there's a number of different tactics that you can use, but the Library of Congress, the Veterans History Project, has what they call a field kit. And if you go to www.libraryofcongress.com/vet, you can download that field kit.
I'm looking
at that. And that walks an interviewer, which I am, with the VA system. That has the questions and gives you an idea, a guide, if you will, of what to do and when to do it. And really, the interview process probably covers five or six categories of questions, which are usually asked by an interviewer. And it starts with just a brief introduction, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it gets an idea of where he was born and where the veteran lived and what year he was born, his mother, his father, brothers and sisters, things like that. Where he went to school, and then it goes on up into his early days of the military. The first thing that has to be done is we have to get a signed signature of release form signed by the veteran if he's still alive, and if not, by his executor or the son or daughter, right, who has or is empowered to sign on his behalf. And once that's signed, the interviewer takes it over, and they start working with the veteran and or his son or daughter, collecting things like that, memorabilia, tapes, whatever they may have, and starts to catalog and correlate and put them all together on behalf of the veteran. The idea is to catch them soon while they're still alive. I lost Buck Huff on the 31st of December this last year. And, you know, these veterans, we lose a World War II veteran every 3 minutes.
So there's not many left. No,
right?
we've got to get them, and the Korean veterans are following quickly behind, and even the Vietnam veterans are starting to fall.
Well, you got to figure the average Vietnam guy, this is the 50th anniversary of the Vietnam War, the average Vietnam guy is 69.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, we are, that's for sure, yeah. Hard to believe, right? Where did that time go?
I don't know. I always tell everybody, you know, that I've got a 20-year-old mind stuck in a 69-year-old body.
Oh, well, there you go.
And it's,
it's
difficult.
Go ahead, John, sorry.
But I was going to say that you've got a I'm looking at the website now for the kit, and anybody can do this, folks. Just type in Google Veterans History Project, and it will take you right to all of these forms that you will need to get for the History Project itself.
Right. There you go.
And there are many people like Ed around the country that are recording these things. In fact, we have a gentleman here in the local Ann Arbor, Ypsilanti area, and that's Bill Villano. And Bill's works with the Ypsilanti District Library, I believe it is, and has been recording veterans for, gosh, as long as I've known him, so I'm almost 10 years. And he unfortunately couldn't make the program today, but wanted to make sure that if you want more information here, especially in our local area, you can just give him a call. Let me just briefly, real quick, everybody get your pencils out. It's Bill Villano, V-O-L-L-A-N-O, and his email is WMJV@ymail.com. The letter ymail.com. So, Bill, there's your plug for you.
Right. And I'll be willing to help, too, if they want to send me an email and say, hey, Ed, I'm having trouble or whatever. I'd be glad to assist and help, and that's all free to the for the vets and anyone trying to capture a veteran story. Might add, too, Dale, that they don't have to go to a VA to get this done.
Right.
It can be done anywhere. It just so happens that I'm with the VA, and I use that as my watering hole, which it is, okay?
Actually,
go anywhere. Just do it. Follow the rules. And you won't have to worry about them sending it back, because they do. There's certain formats that have to be met and certain audios that have to be met and things like that. So it's all in the kit.
Well, mine was done at a local high school. And there are many history teachers out there that are utilizing the Veterans History Project as a way of introducing their students to local veterans. And they find out that, you know, the older gentleman that sits down at the local coffee shop and so on turns out to be a B-17 pilot.
Yep.
Who has amazing stories, and just nobody asks him. So here's an opportunity not only for you as the veteran to get your story out, because I think you guys, men and women, don't know how fascinating these stories are. And 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 100 years from now, people are going to be able to go into the Library of Congress, type in your name, and they're going to hear your story. So your great-great-great-grandchildren will be able to hear your voice explaining whatever it was that you did. I think
that's important to history, too, in maintaining freedom. Also, for vets with PTSD that have, you know, extreme PTSD, it's good therapy for them to tell their story, and they enjoy it. So there's all sorts of benefits.
There are, and I think it's fascinating to know. It is helpful. It is cathartic sometimes for some people. I was talking to someone the other day, and he just opened up and started telling me this amazing story about when he had been in the service, and when he was done, he said, I haven't told anybody that story in 40 years.
There you go.
And,
there you go.
And these are valuable stories. They're valuable lessons, actually, to be learned with these, Ed, I think. And, you know, we keep telling people, you know, if you don't know your history, you're gonna repeat it. And so we have to figure out a way to get these people to know that, you know, going to war is the last possible thing anybody ever wants to do. And so you need to talk to these men and women who have been there. And one of the concerns and complaints about this current political situation going on in Washington is that there are not enough veterans in the Senate and the House of Representatives. So there's not enough.
There you go.
You know, there's not this calming voice in the background that says, hey, you know, before you send these guys off to whatever stand it is that you're going to send them to, think about it. Because are you going to be the one that goes and tells mom and dad, you know, really sorry that, you know, but your son or daughter has died as a result of our mission? So.
Yeah. You're right.
Sorry, that was a little editorial, folks. I'm sorry about
well,
that.
Well, that's all right, you're dead to point, for sure. An interesting story, too, is a part of the history, especially World War II, because there'll never be another war like World War II.
No, there won't.
Just the magnitude of the war alone. And young people today, the youth generation, doesn't get the message about what it was like, what the scope. I just finished interviewing a good friend of mine, Rich Pershawn. He's a B-17 commander, full colonel down at Pima Air Museum in Tucson, Arizona. and he was interviewed by a young news reporter
mm-hmm.
who asked him, just a quick question and didn't really have a clue and said, give me an idea just how big was this. You know, he was talking about a mission. March the 6th was the first daylight bombing into Berlin in 1944. And he said, well, give you an idea. There were 1,000 B-17s in the air. He said the jet stream coming off of those, that's the contrails, was 94 miles long.
Can you ever imagine seeing 1,000 B-17 bombers coming toward you?
There's the scope. Oh, my God. I mean, you just look at that magnitude. And then you look at the Native Americans. I'm taping a couple of those guys that are on Walpole Island. These are Marines, right?
Yep.
And these guys served with some of them served with the 173rd Airborne. Check that one out and see what, the Holocaust. That was Vietnam and the loss of life. Charlie Company is another one. And their stories are getting taped.
Well, Ed, I'm sorry we have run out of time for this segment of the program, but I want to thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio, and I encourage everybody, at least in the Detroit area, if you're at their VA and you see this guy hanging around with a tape recorder, go on up and talk to him. Get your story told. And around the country, we need to get your stories recorded, and we want to continue doing this. Thank you very much, Ed, for being on Veterans Radio.
You're welcome, Dylan. It was a pleasure and an honor.
Thank you very much. We're going to be taking a break here at the bottom with the news. We're going to be coming back and talking about the last days in Vietnam. When we come back after the news and the Medal of Honor segment, you're going to hear Richard Nixon's voice. Don't panic. He's not coming back. But he's going to be talking about the end of the Vietnam War. So stay tuned. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back after the news.
Conway Truckload honors the service of American military men and women with an apprenticeship program that allows veterans to use the GI Bill to supplement their income during their first year driving, as well as tuition reimbursement when they begin. Conway Truckload wants to continue the tradition of service right here at home. To learn more, call 866-WORK-FOR-US or visit online truetoblue.com/military.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
First Lieutenant Jack Jacobs, although seriously wounded, made repeated trips across an open rice paddy, evacuating wounded and their weapons. Details after this.
As a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, joining IAVA.org really helps in the transition home. It's a network of OIF and OEF vets like me who've got your back here, just like we did over there. That means when you need help navigating the GI Bill, we've got your back. And when you're dealing with the transition home, we've got your back. Or when you just want someone to share stories with, we've got your back. Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org. We've got your back.
Brought to you by IAVA and the Ad Council.
Jacob served as an assistant battalion advisor in Kien Phong Province, Republic of Vietnam. The battalion was advancing when it came under intense heavy machine gun and mortar fire. Jacobs called for and directed airstrikes on the enemy positions. Due to the intensity of the enemy fire and heavy casualties to the command group, including the company commander, the attack stopped, and the friendly troops became disorganized. Wounded by mortar fragments, Jacobs assumed command of the company, ordered a withdrawal from the exposed position, and established a defensive perimeter. Despite heavy bleeding from head wounds that impaired his vision, Jacobs returned under intense fire to evacuate a seriously wounded advisor to safety, where he administered life-saving first aid. He then returned through heavy automatic weapons fire to evacuate the wounded company commander. Jacobs made repeated trips across the fire-swept open rice paddies, evacuating wounded and their weapons. On three separate occasions, Jacobs drove off Viet Cong squads who were searching for Allied wounded and weapons, single-handedly killing three and wounding several others. His actions saved the lives of a U.S. advisor and 13 Allied soldiers.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam.
I see trees of green.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and that was President Richard Nixon talking about that we have ended the Vietnam War with honor in 1973. 2 short years later, the North Vietnamese invaded the South, and we ended up having to evacuate Saigon. Today's lesson, I think, is going to be very interesting. Today's program, I'm back in my professorial mode here for suddenly. But today's program is about the last days of Saigon and the last days of the Vietnam War. If you want to get in on the conversation here, give us a call here at Veterans Radio at 734-822-1600, or you can call us toll-free at 844-838-1600. That's 844-VET-1600. Joining us on our line right now is Colonel Stuart Harrington, and let me just give you a little background on this gentleman. He did some really cool stuff. I'm always impressed by some of our guests. Colonel Stuart Harrington retired as a native of Mount Lebanon, Pennsylvania, graduated from Duquesne, political science, commissioned as a second lieutenant, United States Army Intelligence Corps. Then he went on to get a master's degree in international relations, and then he ended up getting a PhD in international relations, completing course in language requirements and all these other things. Ended up, called active duty as a counterintelligence officer with duties in Vietnam, Europe, Middle East, Asia, Latin America, became a German and Vietnamese linguist. Holy mackerel. Served 4 years in Vietnam, 8 years in Germany. And he was one of the last members of the U.S. Army to leave Vietnam as he departed the roof of the United States Embassy. Colonel Harrington, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a real pleasure to talk to you. We, just to remind our audience, we did a program back in 2012 about the evacuation of Saigon. And it's a book called Last Men Out, The True Story of America's Heroic Final Hours, which was a very exciting story. And when I got an opportunity to watch the documentary, The Last Days of Vietnam, I said, oh, I know a couple of these people. We talked to them on our program and learned all about this. Excuse me just a second. And so when you were in Vietnam, 4 tours to me is crazy. But as a career officer, I suppose that would happen. How did you get there first time? What was the first time you were in Vietnam?
I was ordered to Vietnam the first time in January 1971, while the war was still on. And I was sent over there as a captain, Vietnamese linguist, as an intelligence officer working as an advisor to the South Vietnamese military at the tip of the Parrot's Peak on the Cambodian border.
Oh.
And I stayed. I actually extended twice, so my 12-month tour wound up being about a 22-month tour before I went back in mid to late August of 72.
And how did you, and then you went back in 75 again?
Actually, I was back in the States for a little bit less than a year, and I was back over there in August of 73 and stayed until, I was actually supposed to be there till August 75, but the North Vietnamese had other ideas, so I evacuated from the embassy, as you said, on the 30th of April, 75. So second tour was, again, another almost two-year stint from August 73 to 30th of April, 75.
Well, let's bring our audience kind of up to speed on this. You know, I just played a little segment of President Nixon announcing that, you know, the war has ended with honor and so forth, and that we were going to defend South Vietnamese right to remain a democracy. And less than 2 years later, the North Vietnamese came down, and we didn't go. What could you explain that to us a little bit?
Well, as you know, by 73 time frame, when the Paris Agreement was signed, the American public had become totally disenchanted with the war. It just seemed to them that it went on and on. It also seemed to them that our Army and our Marines and our forces on the ground didn't quite have a clue as to what we were doing. And that's another debate. I would argue, and a lot of people argue, that at the beginning we didn't, but we finally figured it out after Tet of 68. But by the time we figured out what was called for, public opinion had already eroded. the media had turned against the war. And out of that, you got Richard Nixon's election and the Paris Agreements, a promise to end the war, and that promise was carried out by the Paris Agreements. They were fatally flawed. We took all remaining Americans out of Vietnam, so there was no American military presence other than 50 of us in the so-called defense attaché office. But it left the North Vietnamese sitting astride huge tracts of South Vietnamese territory. So the Paris Agreement, which was essentially negotiated by the Nixon administration, by Dr. Kissinger, almost at the point of the gun of public relations. I mean, it was clear that the war had to be ended, that we had to get our prisoners back, and that there was little sympathies or patience for the South Vietnamese by that time.
Well, that's true. I remember I was in Vietnam in 1969, and actually I was out in your area of the country quite a bit during that time period. And when I came back, I did not stay, and they came down one day and they said, you know, guys can stay in for the rest of your lives or you can get out today. And I was a warrant officer, so I got out. But I started following it again, and I found that when, you know, President Nixon announced the end of the war, everybody was, you know, all happy, and, well, probably not everybody, but, you know, a lot of people were happy that we were finally getting out and that we were getting in our POWs home. And correct me if I'm wrong, though, and this is the thing that upset me when I watched the documentary, was that it was promised that if South Vietnam was attacked again, that we would come back at least with weapons and everything and protect them, correct?
Yes, more or less. The Paris Agreement contained the authority for any of the signatories, especially meaning the North Vietnamese and us, to replace weapons and equipment on a one-for-one basis. So if the ceasefire didn't hold, if there was attrition of weapons and equipment or if things wore out, one-for-one replacement of arms was permitted. President Nixon went a step further because President Thieu, the South Vietnamese president, was very, very unwilling to sign up to this Paris Agreement, which took the Americans home and left the North Vietnamese in his backyard.
Right.
The president promised the South Vietnamese in writing that should the North Vietnamese violate the ceasefire in a substantial way, the United States would respond with, quote, full force to deal the North Vietnamese a retaliatory blow. So the president made a promise, which unfortunately our system being our system, he can make, but the money and the ability to carry out that promise rested with the Congress. And the Congress was simply not in a mood to sign up to that kind of a bargain. However, Nixon didn't tell the Congress about his letter to the South Vietnamese when he wrote it.
Okay. And then we have Watergate, you know, came about, and Nixon's gone, and they bring back, you know, President Ford is brought in. And the time's already flying by. 15 minutes left. So let's get down to those last days, Colonel. We're talking with Colonel Stuart Harrington, who was in Saigon on the last days when they decided that they'd better evacuate. And you had some issues because there didn't seem to be any plan.
Well, the difficulty was that our ambassador, appointed by the president, was extremely headstrong and adamant that he was not sent to be the ambassador to the Republic of Vietnam, to be the last ambassador. He had lost a stepson in combat in Vietnam. He was absolutely determined that somehow that this was going to have a better than bad ending. And he persuaded himself that the North Vietnamese either didn't have the capability or the will, or in any event would humiliate Washington by overturning the Paris Agreement by a conventional invasion of South Vietnam. So when that happened, and when it became abundantly clear to almost any observer that the North Vietnamese, in the form of 16 divisions, were charging down the countryside, you know, the Highway 1 in broad daylight,
right,
that they were indeed intent upon overturning the ceasefire, the ambassador was in denial, and evacuation, which he deemed as an unthinkable thing, based on his belief that it somehow it would work out. There would be a political settlement. But evacuation was something that we didn't plan for. We didn't talk about it. We didn't utter the E word because of his fear that if the word got out that he, Ambassador Martin, and his mission were focusing on an evacuation, that this would cause panic and loss of any hope on the part of the South Vietnamese. So we were very constrained. It was evident on the one hand that an evacuation and plans for an evacuation to include threatened South Vietnamese who had thrown in their lot with the United States was in order, yet the ambassador was adamant that thou shalt not when it came to discussing evacuation.
Just to remind everybody that coming up on this coming Tuesday, on the 28th, the Last Days of Vietnam, the documentary by Rory Kennedy, is going to be shown on your local PBS station, and that's the reason why we have Colonel Harrington on Veterans Radio today to talk about this. In fact, there's a whole series of programming the next couple of days on PBS that talk about Vietnam, and I would encourage people to check it out just to see. I mean, you may not agree with the politics of the documentaries and so forth, but I think they're great learning lessons. You've got one coming up tomorrow night about the draft. This is something that we've mentioned on Veterans Radio. Dick Cavett, for the people our age, we all know who he is. For the younger people, he was sort of like the, I don't know, no, he wasn't as funny as John Stewart, but he had interviews with many, many people during the Vietnam era, and he's going to replay those. And they also talk about the time when the 1960s died, as they said. So the North Vietnamese are coming down Highway 1. I can remember this like it was yesterday, and I'm sure you do too, but all of the places that I had been in 3 Corps where I was stationed were falling. It seemed like every day another one, from Long Thanh to Tain End to, you know, now you're getting down to, you know, they just kept coming down these highways. You tried to put together a plan. I remember in watching the documentary that there were four potential plans. Could you kind of mention those to us?
Well, there was a JCS, a Joint Chiefs of Staff, operation on, you know, a plan on the shelf, which was later named Operation Frequent Wind, which envisioned the possibility that an evacuation would have to take place. Mind you, this is a Department of Defense plan, whereas on the ground in Vietnam, the ambassador, Department of State, is responsible for evacuation and for the decision as to whether there would be an evacuation. But the plan on the shelf basically talked about how to get Americans out. And the four options, as you've alluded to, had to do with, okay, in a perfect world, we bring people to the waterfront and we put them on ships and they leave. If things are a little tense or if that's not doable, then we can use commercial air, you know, sort of recruit Pan American and other airlines to come into the airport and take people out. That was option two. And option three was the use of military air, C-130s, C-141s at the time, that were bringing military aid, such as was left in the pipeline, to the South Vietnamese. And we could always use military fixed-wing air out of Thun Son Nhut Air Base. And then the dreaded option four was, if all else fails, if we can't avail ourselves of the first three options, then we go to heavy-lift helicopters that basically come in and take out essential Americans to the task force. There was a naval task force out there, Task Force 76. So option four was the last-ditch option, but, of course, on the ground, the major concern of those of us who were there was that none of these options talked about the better part of a quarter to a half a million of Vietnamese, at least many of whom had real reason to need to get out. And so planning was essentially for Americans, and, you know, moving from that concept and going beyond that to, wait a minute, what about our Vietnamese allies, was the major challenge of the day.
Well, that's true. And I'm, of the people that were in Vietnam, you knew how many civilian contractors there were, how many Vietnamese nationals were working inside the various bases doing all kinds of jobs. And, you know, for their cooperation, of course, with the Americans, they were going to be the ones that were going to be punished when the Americans left. And so you were left with the responsibility, it seems like you mostly, to figure out a way to get these people out. And there's a nice quote here that says that sometimes there's an issue not of legal and illegal, but of right or wrong. And that's where you stepped up to the plate. Colonel, and started getting these people out. Could you address that a little bit?
Yes. It should be noted, though, that, you know, while the documentary focuses on a few folks who did what they considered to be right and even broke the rules, knowing that there were consequences if the ambassador found out, that it wasn't just me. I mean, I had a boss, a lieutenant colonel, and his boss, a colonel. We were negotiations staff officers for the POW-MIA negotiation element, and they were certainly absolutely all for doing whatever was necessary to get threatened Vietnamese out. There were State Department officers who broke the rules. There were USAID officers, intelligence officers, people like myself, my bosses, where quietly and without any coordination with one another, we just basically arranged to get people out. We used every subterfuge known to man to include, you know, box-bodied trucks with a U.S. Embassy license plate to stuff 50 people in and get them to the flight line and, you know, push them aboard an empty C-130 that was on its way back to the Philippines for example, disguising threatened Vietnamese in one of them who had a child by an American in a nun's outfit on Operation Baby Lift, the orphan lift, to where our way of getting this woman out and her child, whose father was at the Philippines, was to bring her onto a C-130 carrying an orphan, except it was really her child, and then the crew secreted her in the cockpit, and she got out. By hook or by crook, by any means or any subterfuge that we could think of, we essentially started bringing out hundreds and ultimately thousands of Vietnamese who were threatened. For example, our military counterparts in the POW-MIA negotiations business, there were about 300 South Vietnamese involved in that, and they all had families, and we took all their families out, about 1,100 or 1,200 folks. And we got permission from Washington to break the rules, to stuff them all on a empty C-141. We had to get them sneaked onto Tonsonewit. Bribes were sometimes paid in order to get on the base. And then things like, you know, driving them in buses, but driving them from the far side of the terminal so that the Vietnamese officers who were pulling security for the terminal didn't see that we were on the other side of the aircraft loading it up with people who were leaving. So it was a loosey-goosey thing. It was in direct violation of the ambassador's rules, but we did it because, as you alluded to, it was the right thing to do.
It was the right thing to do. And as you watch this documentary, and I encourage our audience to watch this, The Last States in Vietnam, it's on PBS. It's part of the American Experience series of programmings on Tuesday night, 9 o'clock Eastern Time, to check your local PBS station to see when this program might be on. But when I was watching a documentary, North Vietnamese are coming down Highway 1, as you mentioned, down through Long Binh and so forth, and now they started rocketing Tonsonewit, and so that eliminated the big aircraft. So now you do have to go to the heavy lift helicopters to get them out, correct?
That's right. On the night of the 29th, early morning hours of the 29th, about 4 o'clock, the North Vietnamese launched their final attack against the city of Saigon. And this was an attack that came from three or four axes and directions by the better part of 16 divisions, massive artillery, 130-millimeter field guns, 122-millimeter howitzers, 122-millimeter rockets. And their first target that they focused on was Tonsonewit and the air base. And so within a matter of a couple of hours, there were dozens of airframes burning. The runway was cluttered with ordnance. The South Vietnamese, seeing that this was happening and deducing it was the very last act in the drama, many of them got in their aircraft with their families, jettisoned their ordnance, live ordnance, all over the runway and flew to Thailand or wherever they could find safekeeping. So when the sun came up on the morning of the 29th of April, two Marines, Corporals McMahon and Judge, were dead from a 122 rocket. The order had been and was about to be given to go to option four, and our little MIA negotiations team was ordered to the U.S. Embassy. And our orders were to go to the embassy and be prepared to stay after the evacuation to continue negotiations on the POW-MIA question.
Well, this is an exciting story, folks, and you've got to go and see this when you get the opportunity, because, you know, you've all seen the pictures. First of all, you know, one of the pictures of people supposedly on the embassy roof, you know, going up these stairs to get on the helicopter, that was at another building. It wasn't at the embassy. But then the helicopter is going out, flying out into the South China Sea, attempting to land on some of these ships that were out there. And they only had little landing pads, and that's one of the reasons that they ended up throwing them into the South China Sea. Obviously, you got out, but you were there at the very end. Were you up on that roof when you didn't think they were coming back to get you?
Actually, there were two dramas there. The first was when the president ordered an end to the evacuation, and myself and my two bosses, Lieutenant Colonel Summers, Colonel Madison, our three NCOs, who had been handling the actual marshaling of the refugees, putting them into groups of 50, getting them to throw away their suitcases, getting them to, you know, be calm, cooperative, otherwise no one would get out. We were told at around 5 a.m. that the president had ordered an end to the evacuation. My boss, Colonel Madison, told the Marine officer who imparted the bad news that was unacceptable, that we'd been promised the helicopters, that there were only 420 people left in the parking lot, and then it would be a clean sweep. And the Marine said, "I'm sorry, sir, but it's over. It's a presidential order." And when Colonel Madison said, "I'll take this up with the ambassador," the Marine pointed to a CH-46 lifting off the roof of the embassy and said, "You can't, sir. That's him. In that helicopter." So at that point, we were stuck, and the last drama of the U.S. Army in Vietnam happened when Colonels Madison and Summers went up to the roof with most of our NCOs, told me to stay in the parking lot and keep the refugees, the 420, warm so they wouldn't panic if we all left at the same time.
Right.
And eventually, you know, 5:30 in the morning on the 30th of April, I broke myself away from the group, went to the roof, and got on a helicopter along with our two remaining NCOs, and the U.S. Army presence in Vietnam ended at that moment for the history of the war. However, still in the compound, apart from the unlucky 420 whom we had promised safe haven, there were about three platoons of Marines who'd been brought in earlier in the day from the fleet to help guard the, you know, protect the embassy walls. Then there was a squad of 11 Marines from the embassy security guard detachment. And you probably surely interviewed Top Gunnery Sergeant Juan Valdez.
That's the one.
Major.
That's the one.
Yeah, you probably know Top. He's a superlative NCO. He and 10 others, including Major Keen, the Marine security mm-hmm. guard company commander, after they took out the three platoons of Marines, it was announced that the evacuation was over, that the ambassador was out, and it was closeout, finished. At that point, though, there were still 11 Marines on the roof who had somebody, when they were doing the counting, just miscounted and miscalculated. And even after Dr. Kissinger gave a Washington press conference in which he said, "We got everyone out who needed to get out, and, you know, it's over, and congratulations to the heroic people who made it happen," there were still 11 Marines on the roof of that embassy. And there were 420 very angry people in the parking lot.
I can understand that. People are going to have to tune in to see what happens to this thing on Tuesday night, Last Days of Vietnam on the American Experience on PBS. Colonel Harrington, thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. I would love to talk to you again and have you back on the program. This is just an amazing story to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. It was my honor.
Thank you. All right, folks, this is what you got to do. Turn on the TV on Tuesday night. I hate to say that in a different form of media, but watch those programs. I think you're going to learn something that you didn't know about Vietnam. So on behalf of all of us here at Veterans Radio, I want to thank you again for listening. You are dismissed.